Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This is Writers on Film, the only podcast dedicated to books on cinema. Hello everybody and welcome to Writers on Film. My name is John Bleasdale. I am a writer and film critic, and today I am talking to Kyle Turner, who is the author of The Queer Film Guide, 100 Films That Tell LGBTIA Plus Stories. It's a wonderful book published by Smith Street with great illustrations by Andy Warren. The book is great and I'm really looking forward to talking to Kyle. He has had his work published in a lot of different places, based in Brooklyn. He's published in GQ, Paste Magazine, The Village Voice, New York Times, NPR, Slate, a lot of different places. And so I'm really glad to have the opportunity to welcome him onto the show. Thank you to Elliot Atkins for the music, and thanks to Ali Harwood for the art. And remember, if you like, you can follow us on Twitter at Dr. John T. D. R. J. O. N. T. Y. Please remember to go over and check my new podcast, Cinema Italia, which is currently in its 7th or 8th episode. It's a really good, accessible dive into Italian cinema, and I'm including all Italian films from Silence to Spaghetti Westerns, Giallo, Polizetski, Sorrentino, Fellini, everything. So neorealism, everything. So if you haven't had a listen, be sure and give it a go and see what you think. It's hopefully going to introduce some great new films to you, and also go over some great classics as well. Okay, that's enough. Before you do any of that, enjoy the conversation.
I think queerness means something different to everyone, especially those who experience it. It encompasses so many different perspectives and ideas and experiences. And I was hoping that the films that I selected for the book could be representative of that fluidity, could be representative of that malleability, because you have, of course, films with explicit and over LGBTQ IA plus representation, but you also have things that are a little bit more allegorical or metaphorical, like The Fly, the David Cronenberg film, which is timed very uncannily to the AIDS crisis in 1985. You have something like Jennifer's Body, which is very much an interrogating female friendship in a sort of homoerotic way. You have Beau Travail, the Claire Denis film, which is clearly about like masculine envy. So I thought it was important to sort of like survey the way in which queerness could exist as these different things within film itself, not only as the desire that exists, that sort of is transferred between two characters, but also as a sensibility or a perspective or an aesthetic point of view. Even something like everyone has an understanding that John Waters' Pink Flamingos is queer, but I think sometimes people struggle to articulate why that is. And I think that is very much has to do with is so confrontational and abrasive about its connection to normative ideas of taste and aesthetic. So I wanted to make sure that there was a pretty wide understanding or a varied understanding of what queerness could be in this book.
Yeah, that's so interesting. When I was looking through, Fly was one of those where I went, oh, wait a minute, how does that work? And then as I went through, of course, I remember The Fly coming out at the time and being seen very immediately as a metaphor for AIDS.
Yeah, and I think David Cronenberg's films, I think what some audiences may not necessarily be aware of is that though he is like a straight identified filmmaker, his films have been embraced by the queer community because of their ability to investigate these really, I think, profound and tactile ideas of what it means to be human, the way that our flesh and our bodies can sometimes be under scrutiny or surveillance by these larger systems and larger societies. A Videodrome, of course, The Fly, even something like Eastern Promises or Existence, they're very much by the way in which bodies are sort of interpolated by these broader systems and determined what they mean and what their value is against other bodies.
Yeah, that's so fascinating. Of course, he made Naked Lunch as well. I remember when he was being interviewed for that, him sort of confronting that problem of being a, as you say, a straight identifying filmmaker and dealing with, you know, an iconic key queer text in William S. Burroughs' novel. What about your, in terms of yourself coming to film, what's your sort of backstory in terms of how do you get to be writing this book, and what are the films that are sort of first having an impact on your life?
The apocryphal origin story, as I like to tell it, is when I was 4 or 5, my mother showed me Howard Hawks' Bringing Up Baby from 1938 with Cary Grant and Katharine Hepburn.
Bless your mother.
Yeah. I was not allowed to watch Disney Renaissance movies. So the like Little Mermaid and Aladdin and Lion King and all that, because I was homeschooled very briefly before I entered elementary school, which is like first grade, second grade, et cetera. And throughout like the homeschool group that I was a part of at the time, apparently there was the rumor or the conversation being circulated that there was subliminal imagery in those movies, that the animators had put like different sexual innuendos and whatnot. And that is a rumor that persists on the internet today. But because I wasn't allowed to watch those, my mother showed me screwball comedies from the studio era, like His Girl Friday and Bringing Up Baby. And Bringing Up Baby, where there is an anal sex joke in the first 5 minutes. So it's an interesting sort of redirection of my attention. But watch that. And then I started a blog when I was like 13, and I was always trying to sneak in stuff about movies in my homework. And I knew from second grade on that I wanted to write about film or be a film critic or something. And then I just sort of like had intense tunnel vision about that aspiration. And I started writing on the internet when I was like a sophomore in high school and started freelancing in a more professional capacity senior year of high school, freshman year of college. And I've been freelancing for the last 8 or 9 years, and my work has been in like GQ and The Village Voice. And as far as this book goes, long-winded way of saying I was approached by the Australian publisher Smith Street Books for this opportunity, which I'm incredibly grateful for. They had previously published a book called The Feminist Film Guide by Mallory Andrews, and she's a really wonderful critic who I knew through Twitter, and she had been the editor of Clio Journal, which was a feminist film journal based in Canada. And they asked her, like, if they had any ideas for who they could get to write the queer film guide. And she gave them my name, and they approached me last May, and I was extremely excited. And I was like, yes, absolutely. I'd be happy to do that. Because sort of exploring and understanding my own sense of queerness and my identity in college, like 1920, I was having these like really incredible conversations with one of my favorite professors, Margaret Greenlaw, and also Robert Lang. And I was really coming to understand how film could be a form of queer creative expression. And I was really interested in how that could be an aspect of film that I could study and become passionate about, because previously I just sort of had this like, I loved movies, but I had a generalist knowledge, and I wanted to have something that could be a tool of self-knowledge and exploration, and queer cinema ended up being that thing. So writing this book feels sort of like a full circle moment.
Yeah. Do you think in writing itself, there is a kind of a queer eye, if you permit me the phrase, in the sense that when I was reading your book, there's a real verve to the writing, and there's a real, you know, snap to it, and there were some words that were coming up which you know, in terms of maybe my awareness is a little bit limited, but you know, what was the phrase? Oh, queerdos. I just thought, oh, that's that's brilliant. I want to know if that's your coinage or not. Are you aware of that sort of informing your writing on a level of sort of the language you're using and the voice that you have?
Well, first of all, thank you so much. That really means a lot to me. I feel like I've been, you know, just behind a typewriter or a keyboard for so many years, and it feels very special to have people recognize the hard work that I've been doing. As far as having a queer eye for language or for style or syntax, I, for the record, did not coin the term queerdos. I think that's okay. Something that is sort of passed around from person to person, and I'm happy to be able to carried along with me. But I think it's been a journey over the last several years to figure out where my observations about queerness and identity and sexuality can coalesce into a sense of style, and figure out the vocabulary and the construction of certain words or sentences, so that they are able to convey both like a unique point of view with regards to my queerness and in the context of this book, queerness more broadly, and also be able to convey that in an accessible and fun manner. Like, I would like to think that, generally speaking, that my writing style is fun to read in general, or at least not uninteresting. But this book posed a really compelling challenge in that, like, writing a blurb, you're doing a bunch of things at once, and that because of the format of this book, which is 100 main entries, all about 350 or so words, you have to tell the audience what the movie is and describe what the movie is, and then you have to tell them what's unique about it, and then you also have to provide your own point of view about what is unique about it or what's interesting and worth watching. And that was definitely a challenge, and definitely work, but it was exciting to be able to figure out how to blend all those different functionalities, I guess, of the writing together, and see how I could put it in my voice, and see how I could make it exciting and fun to read. I it was a big goal was how can I get someone to watch this movie? Yeah, I think it was fairly simple in that way. How can I get someone to watch this movie? Especially with some of the selections that like people already know about, Brokeback Mountain or Hedwig and the Angry Inch or the Rocky Horror Picture Show. It was, how can I show an audience who's heard of this movie and give them a reason to actually take a look at it? Because you can Google so many different reviews and essays about many of these films, but not only is it what do I have to say about it, but like what is the thing going to be to get someone to not just look at this page, but also maybe rent it on YouTube or Amazon or buy the Criterion Blu-ray or something. How can I use language as a way to convey like what's exciting about this movie and why it deserves attention? Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, absolutely it does. And I mean, I think there's so there are some classic movies here which are, you know, are undeniably queer cinema in terms of their their stated purpose, let's say, I don't want to go into intentionality too much, but I think some of the things you have to do just because of the very nature of the law, I kind of knew this, but didn't know I knew this. But when you write about the adventures of Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, Al Clark, by the way, the producer of that film, was on the podcast a few weeks ago.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, he's a wonderful guy, wonderful producer. He actually was going around when they were sort of location shooting for that. He went around with the writer and director, and they had the... some dresses in the back of the van, and they would jump out at Ayers Rock and put on the drag and take photographs of each other to use that to sort of sell the idea of the film to other people. So it was a great, great little anecdote. But you know, you mentioned in that you know the law in Tasmania isn't, you know, homosexuality is still illegal in 1997. I mean, 1997. Mm-hmm. So when you're looking at a lot of these films, the idea of what you said earlier about sort of the queerness has to some degree be sort of coded and you have to look in and sort of pull it out. It's not, it's part of its DNA that it is coming out via codes and via sort of hidden away just to survive.
Mm-hmm. I think as not to make broad generalizations, but for a long time as queer people, we had very little else but to use that language of reading into things, reading queerness into things and looking for these signs and signals. It wasn't just out of a level of wish fulfillment or paranoia that these people existed, but the fact that like many queer people did exist in the film industry in Hollywood, and they were putting these things in movies as a way to signal to other people in the audience, you know, that they're one of us, so to speak. Sometimes it wasn't even intentionally to signal to audiences that someone queer was behind the camera or in some sort of creative role, but also it was just an expression of themselves. It was also sometimes just a way to challenge or move forward the story or the aesthetic. Like one of my best friends, professors at Manhattanville, spent a lot of his research examining the Hays production era and the Hays production code and the things that were intentionally taken out of movies. Mm-hmm. Because when you were submitting your film this was prior to the Motion Picture Association of America, where you would get a rating. You would submit it to the studios, and they would tell you to take things out and whatnot. Anything that sort of transgressed those normative values, no interracial relationships, no premarital sex, yada, 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 obviously no queer people. And so you can, there are paper trails as to what was not allowed in movies. Mm-hmm. And anything that was too uncouth or too queer or too suggestive So you can look at these different reports and glean from them, like, what certain things were, what things were in movies that would indicate, like, some sort of other within society. And I think that's really, really fascinating that it, that both the ability to read into movies, but also see where something was taken out. I think that's such an interesting part of, especially like Western and American film history. And it requires, I think, for viewers to be active in their participation, as opposed to just passively watching something. I think what could be exciting about this book and exciting about watching the movies in this book is that even if it's not obvious, you're encouraged to engage with the movie and have a dialogue with the film. And I think sometimes, this is me and my old like crotchety soapbox. I think sometimes viewers can be a little bit too passive. I think what's fun about cinema is that not only is a tool of self-knowledge and a way to understand the world around us, or to as a refraction of the world around us, there's a real potential to engage and talk back at the movie or talk with the movie, and understand how the film is negotiating all these different ideas and these different like social, sexual politics. And so I always think that that is a really fun sort of challenge to have as a viewer.
Following on from that, I think your description of William Friedkin's Cruising, I was really, really interesting, because I love that film and I know it's a bit of a controversial film. And yet you sort of nailed, I mean, I don't mean you nailed it because you agreed with me. It was when I read it, I kind of went, ah, that's it. That's exactly it. The idea that the camera kind of follows the Al Pacino's main character in the way it looks at things. It looks at things homophobically to begin with, cliches and stereotypes, and then sort of a slightly morbid fascination of like, oh, what the hell's going on here? And then by the end of it, it's kind of like really comfortable with the world that it's in, you know? I just thought that was a really interesting point of view. And also, in terms of what you said, it's that idea of an interaction with a film rather than just like, I'm going to sit here passively and you tell me what I want to hear. It's like, I'm going to be disturbed and upset by some of this. I have to come on a journey, you know?
Yeah, you're going to be probed by it, prodded. Cruising has become a... When people have been asking me like what my favorite queer film is sort of throughout this process, I've been going back to Cruising because it is so fertile for exploration and consideration, and it inspires so many fun conversations. I just did a screening of it at the Roxy Cinema in New York, a double feature of Cruising and the Jan Gonzalez 2018 French slasher movie Knife Plus Heart. And how the film, it was really fun to put those films in dialogue with one another. But Cruising is just like, it's, I think we, at least I have the benefit of time retrospective and whatnot to be able to think and engage with this movie sort of outside of its original context a little bit, while understanding the context of its original release in 1980. Bad timing, like great movie, bad timing. Like the New York Anti-Violence Project was created in the late 1970s to address very, very real anti-queer violence. And like William Friedkin was like, yeah, I'm going to make this movie about like murders happening to the gay community. Not great timing, but like I find his willingness to get into the muck of what I think a lot of mainstream queer people were kind of unwilling to acknowledge about, you know, the reality of some of our lives. Like it shouldn't really matter, but like the sex that some people enjoy is a little bit more unusual, or it deviates from traditional ideas of like what sex looks like. And that deserves as much respect and is as valid as any other kind of sex. But to use this as like a social setting and as a political setting, I think is really fascinating, because it requires a level of adventurousness or boldness to make the connection between the kind of aesthetic that is being fetishized within a queer community, which draws a lot from the iconography of the police state and fascism and Nazism and whatnot, and to connect that between like the rate at which the queer people were or were not being accepted in society, and sort of the politics of New York of the era, because it's very much pre-Rudy Giuliani, very Ed Koch era, trash everywhere. It stinks. It's like you can feel the grime of it. So it's really, I think it's like really fun to think about how William Friedkin is using this like sexual subculture as a way to describe or to illustrate like what American politics look like at the time, even if it means sort of like using a very messy, messy metaphor as a way to get there. And the fact that he sort of implicates the viewer in that by having these like slow pans and dollies across these leather bars, the fact that we are ourselves becoming more and more intrigued by this world, that we are becoming more fascinated, more immersed in it, I think that's so exciting to be a part of.
And kind of getting used to as well. I mean, as you're watching it, you're sort of like, well, I mean, I'm talking from my own sort of chiz straight perspective, but I'm watching it going, oh, what's this? I've never seen this before. And then, like, oh, okay, I'm used to it now. Yeah, yeah. And you also have that idea of the fish out of water formula or trajectory that a Hollywood movie has, where you have this Al Pacino character who is, at the time, one of the biggest heartthrobs Hollywood has to offer, and he's kind of, yeah, his sexuality is up for grabs, literally.
Yeah, and he was such a, and I think continues to be such an icon of a certain kind of 70s masculinity. He is very much of the like Robert De Niro, Taxi Driver, Robert De Niro, Willem Dafoe. That whole era of like Paul Schrader, Martin Scorsese, like kind of masculinity where they're sort of adrift, they're sort of recovering from the national trauma of like the Vietnam War and Nixon and whatnot. And having him, who we usually associate with having a very strong sense of self, like when we see Al Pacino on the screen, very rarely will we think, that guy doesn't know who he is. That guy is having some sort of like existential crisis. But to reframe how we understand Al Pacino's iconography, I think is really, really exciting and disturbing and scary in a productive way. I usually describe Cruising to friends who have not seen it as like, Cruising is homophobic, but in the best way possible.
In a productive way.
Yeah.
So let's go back a little bit, because also the other thing that is interesting is you start off with a couple of silent films and semi-silent films. Yes, you start with Different from Others. Is the first film you mention?
I mentioned Wings. I did not include Wings. I mean, that is the tragedy of having limited space in like a set 100. There are a bunch of movies that were sort of like up in the air, especially if I want to articulate the idea that queerness has been on film for almost as long as film itself has existed, but also get to presentations that were a little bit more direct and a little bit easier, I think, for audiences to sort of wrestle with. There were a bunch of films that I had to pick from in order to explore that idea, while also being able to sort of like since the book is framed chronologically, so pick those movies and then also move forward in time to show an evolution of what queerness looked like on the screen and how queerness was being discussed culturally and socially. And so Different from the Others is the first one. And I think it's useful that is the first one, the first official entry in the book, partially from like a historical perspective. 1919, it was very much a product of these basically educational films that Dr. Magnus Hirschfeld was making with filmmakers at the time in Weimar era Berlin. And to sort of contrast that brief queer or social utopia that existed at the time, even as it was, even if that film was being used with a with a fairly particular purpose, which was to educate and to inform other people in Germany, because there was still a penal code that outlawed homosexuality at the time, and contrast that against later films where, even as they're being released in the 2020s, that there is this kind of juxtaposition against a cultural landscape in which queerness is much more broadly accepted, but also that we are living in a time in the United States, at least, although the conservative right wing backlash is kind of global, but that there was a kind of a similarity, or at least a mirroring of what was going on, despite the fact that we have I think the cultural fluency around queerness is significantly different than in 1919.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I did want to bring this up, and I promise we'll sort of get to sort of lighter issues as well, because I don't want this to be just like, wow, how terrible things can be. But I've noticed recently that I think homophobia and transphobia is like being exploited as almost like the tip of the spear of a far right culture of sort of hatred. And I mean, in the space of the last month, we've gone from very basic transphobia to drag shows being picketed, books being banned, and all of a sudden Pride, which has kind of not even been controversial for like the last 10-20 years, has suddenly become a target for this sort of concerted hatred. I mean, yeah, that's my point of view, just as a being outside of the community. But I mean, what's your take from within?
Well, personally, I think gays don't deserve rights. No, that's
it's a surprise, but let's pursue that.
From the author of the Queer Film Guide, queers don't deserve rights. It's really rough,
right?
And it's hard not to find.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
It kind of depressing. And I do not lay blame for the queer community about this. I think that I think conservatives would have found a way with the different tools at their disposal, especially the fact that so many Silicon Valley people do swing conservative and do have a lot of power and do have a lot of influence over politicians, at least in the United States. I can't necessarily speak to things more internationally, but I think the existence of these different platforms and apparatuses certainly has been almost instrumental in being able to spread and give power to those outside of the United States as well. In terms of voicing these bigoted and harmful and oppressive beliefs, which then sort of get recycled and weaponized by those who are actually in power and have the means to make other people's lives miserable. Long circuitous way of saying, I think it reveals the ultimately problematic way that a lot of queer politics has sort of aimed its primary goals at assimilating into society. And that is purely my perspective. I understand that there are definitely useful ways to, and understandable reasons as to why marginalized communities would want that. Marginalized communities, regardless of whether they are queer or of racial or ethnic or religious or able-bodied backgrounds, et cetera, deserve equity and justice regardless. And I think what we are seeing is the failure that, like, if the queer community was going to primarily focus its efforts on marriage, it meant that, like, other people were who don't want that or didn't have access to it or didn't have the resources to access it, yada, 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 would not necessarily fall under the purview of those who are protected, those who, people who don't want, like, the middle class lifestyle, picket fence, children, et cetera, wouldn't necessarily have access to those rights or those protections. And that so much energy was spent on trying to get those things, I think it's become much easier to have those things sort of like thrown back in our faces, because as useful as marriage is as a financial decision and as a tax reason in the United States, it is not a band-aid for everything. Like, it doesn't solve a lot of like the policy issues regarding homelessness or employment. And it's really scary and upsetting and frustrating to see things that were 3 or 4 years ago under like liberal-ish or neoliberal political circumstances, that these things are now like subject to just to like intense hatred and discrimination. It's really, I apologize for not being able to sound articulate about this.
No, just, no.
It's ridiculous. It's like, it is like, in a less refined way, it's like ridiculous. Like, I saw a TikTok of like the school librarian who was being asked to like throw out all of these books because they were like too woke. And I'm like, these were very, very basic history books. And I'm curious, the sense of fascism is it feels like so visceral, and even though I'm based in New York, and I think I'm in a position of like extreme privilege, being middle-ish class lifestyle in Brooklyn, with my like lefty friends, still there is enough proximity to these things that are happening. It is unbelievable, and it feels unfortunate and upsetting to like not know what to do. And what is also like deeply upsetting is the fact that like many of the people who are doing this, they're not the majority. Like, so many like different official and unofficial polls, like the Pew Research Center, and different like political polls that have been done by different outlets and publications, are like, we don't care about people, like in a different way that like isn't great, but at least has this like tone of like, of we will leave them alone. Like, it doesn't matter to us one way or the other. And it's really just like us, a relatively small group of people that are extremely loud and have incredible access to resources and to policy and to law and whatnot, that are making these decisions, which are harming so many people. And it's a terrible sense of whiplash, especially when we thought that that there was a bit of progress as far as being able to live in a world where self-expression was not so under such scrutiny that would cause such harm. Sorry, that's a very long ramble.
No, it's not. It's really interesting. I really wanted to get your perspective on it. And I totally agree with you. I think there's been this, I think there is a temptation because this is a very minority, it's a very hateful minority. They know that they can't just say, hey, guys, gay people are bad. Let's go back a bit, because nobody would support them and everybody would laugh them out of town. So what they do is they target certain very particular groups. They're not targeting sort of a gay couple who are married. They're targeting some sort of fetishists here or some sort of, and they're going, but look at what they're doing in front of children. And they keep bringing up children in a very toxic way as well. And the temptation is to throw those people under the bus, is to say, yeah, that's a bit too much. We shouldn't have that in our pride parade. And it's just like, no, fuck these guys. They don't surrender anybody. Not only for the homosexuals, for the LGBTQ plus community, but also for heterosexuals who might want to have non-normative sex in ways that isn't sort of widely understood or cared about. So I just, your anger is utterly justified, and I'm glad to hear it.
Happy Pride Month. Happy Monday.
Yeah, exactly. But okay, let me get to to some of the more, let's have some more fun. One film that I loved that you included in the book, and I imagine it was a no-brainer, Funeral Parade of Roses. This is stunning.
So
yeah. Can you tell us a little bit about that for any of the listeners who might not have had an opportunity to see this yet?
Yeah. So Funeral Parade of Roses is a film from 1969, directed by Toshio Matsumoto. Matsumoto was, his career was starting around the Japanese New Wave, which had a lot of inspiration from the French New Wave, obviously. So like Seijun Suzuki and Nagisa Oshima. But he was, Matsumoto was really interested in like the way that film could create these worlds of fiction and reality. And he wanted to explore this underground world of queer and basically trans sex workers called gay boys. And he wanted to use that social setting to make a film that was part narrative reimagining of Oedipus Rex by Sophocles, part documentary about the social and cultural landscape of this underground Tokyo queer scene, and then part experimental film to explore like the way that this world exists kind of within but also apart from like mainstream Japanese society. And so what you have is like is this like incredibly kaleidoscopic and wild and crazy and fun and shocking film about desire and sexuality and identity and the nature of cinema itself as a way to sort of perpetuate or to craft what identity is, because you have this, like one of the very early shots in the film is through a mirror. You're watching one of the main characters sort of in a post-coitus scene as they're discussing their relationship and the sort of rivalry that exists between one of the girls at the brothel and another one. And it's shot through a mirror, and it slowly pans away to reveal like where these two characters are in the room after they've had sex. And it's really, really incredible. It has a sense of cartoonish fun. It is one of the, I think, few examples of trans cinema that I am aware of. I would definitely refer to scholars and critics who have who are much better versed in the history of trans specific cinema than I am, like Willow McClay Caitlin and Juan Barkeen and Caden Mark Gardner and Liz Purcell, who are all really, really wonderful critics and scholars, and without whom this book would not exist, for the record. But like, it's a film that is able to encapsulate like the contradictions and complexities of transness, but in a way that doesn't sort of like focus or only exist within a space of trauma, I guess. Trauma is like a really big sort of subject matter that people love talking about these days, especially with regards to movies that deal with marginalized communities. But this film is not just that. It explores like the absurdity of like getting into fights with other women, getting into fights with other trans women, and how catty and, am I allowed to swear on this podcast?
Yeah, yeah, go ahead.
How catty and bitchy girls can be. How catty, and I am borrowing this word from the community, how mean the dolls can be, as it were.
Yeah.
It's falls into this like perfect, it falls into this perfect category of movies in this book that are like really rigorous and invigorating and challenging, but also like really fun to watch. This is a movie that I really like showing to people because even though it's sort of outre and avant-garde and is combining all these different cinematic techniques and expressions, that it's just like really entertaining. It's a good watch. I showed it at the LGBT Center in New York recently, and I was like really surprised and delighted to find that that it was an almost full house, which was really cool. But like everyone had a good time. It's there's this misconception that a lot of queer films, especially, are nothing but depressing, nothing but like AIDS stories and death stories and whatnot. But I think that is a misrepresentation of the breadth of queer cinema. And I think Funeral Parade of Roses is a really nice reply to that idea, because it does engage in these ideas of like what it means to be, you know, an outcast in society, but it's also like really funny. It deals with like women arguing with each other in like in their own language.
Mm, absolutely. And I mean, you don't necessarily need his seal of approval, but Stanley Kubrick often quoted it as one of his favorite films, and a huge, huge influence on Clockwork Orange as well.
Yes, yes, yes. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Given that, I love that we after having that great big moan, which was a thoroughly deserved moan, we should sort of emphasize the positive with this, and that's a really good point of sort of you know, you want to have queer cinema which is celebratory, without obviously, you know, just dumping the realities and the political realities and marginalization, what have you, and the various problems, you know, completely. But you do want to not fall into this sort of you know, Philadelphia / Brokeback Mountain, as good as as that might be, being the only story we can tell.
Right. I think the story, if I were to make it a very broad pronouncement, I think the story of queer cinema is one of survival. And survival means not just like going through the trudge of tragedy, but also finding joy and community and connection. And one of the cinema has always been, for me, a tool of connection and finding people like myself, finding people to share things with. And I think the best of queer cinema is about that. It's about like throughout any sort of like political or social or cultural ostracization, that there's still a way to express one's sense of self and identity and what we want, what we don't want, what things are important to us. From the perspective often of like outsiders looking in, that we can still find that power.
Yeah. And I'm someone who's definitely been educated via cinema, in the sense that, you know, my upbringing, you know, was from the 90s, you know, starts in the 1970s in a small village in northern England. And, you know, I've had to go on a very interesting journey. You know, I come from working class background with parents who came from very traditional, my mum's Catholic, so very traditional background. And cinema has been, you know, a brilliant way of sort of opening my eyes to other communities, as well as obviously I went to Liverpool, went to lots of different places, yeah, and found lots of different communities as well. But there's something about cinema that you know, it allows you to observe things that you wouldn't necessarily get the opportunity to observe, and to confront you with things. There's something safe in the darkness there in order to do that as well. One other question I wanted to ask is, of course, LGBTQ+ is by its very definition and becoming a very broad different spectrum, a rainbow, if you like, of different colors.
Yeah.
see what I did there? How do you balance that as a queer man? Are you looking at this and just aware, oh, I've got this, how do I balance my lesbian, my bisexual, my trans cinema? Is there a preoccupation there, or was it pretty easy?
The way that I bounce them is that it's sort of like Noah's Ark, and that I have at least two, and they're paired together, and they raise their hands. When I was compiling the list, the preliminary list for the book, it wasn't just out of like the necessity or the virtue signaling, if you will, of wanting to include as much as possible and check boxes, yada, yada, yada. But like, as a queer person of color myself, for those of who are playing at home and are just looking at my name, I'm not actually white, even though people would beg to differ based on my dating track record. But as a queer person of color, I am aware of the realities of having different identities intersect with one another and impact the way that you're perceived and negotiate and move about the world. And I think it would have been intellectually dishonest to not be as inclusive as possible, because, I'm aware of the problem of canon making and whatnot, and I want people to think of this book as a queer film guide, not the film guide. A queer film guide, not the queer film guide, even though that is the title. I want this to be like a jumping off point for people to explore other expressions of film, other movies that may not be included in the book, other directors that are referenced and whatnot. But anyway, I think it was like really important to be able to take what I've learned as a queer person and having these people either really explicitly in my immediate life or tangentially through being parts of other people's communities and whatnot, for them to be represented and seen in this book. Obviously, there is a problem with regards to the way that resources are allocated to people and their ability to imagine or bring their creative projects to fruition because of the systems and apparatuses that may not allow them to do such. But like, because queerness encompasses and contains so many different ideas and experiences and lives, I thought it was intellectually important and necessary that I try to honor that, and not just, again, not just out of the politically convenient way, but because even if I don't know everyone in every community, it's important to me that like there's a sense of like, this sounds silly, but like cinematic solidarity. Like, even if I don't know like every, obviously I'm not going to know like every trans person or every intersex person or whatever, but like being able to engage with their stories and or our stories has been like an important part of my own identity formation, to understand their point of view and what their desires, their wants, and stories. I think the best that you can do is try to make sure that other people are as curious or as have the opportunity to explore those stories as well. And even though it's, you know, within the constraints of the format, it was like kind of difficult just being able, just in terms of like, you know, wanting to include as much as possible so that it's like a fair and unique representation of queer cinema. I think if I had not done that, it would be like a significantly worse book.
Yeah.
Like a diversity and variation of what queerness looks like and means to other people is like, I think should be a testament to what queerness should look like in general.
Absolutely. I mean, I hesitated really to ask that question in a way, because reading through the book and looking through the different films that you'd selected, it struck me that there's such a rich you know, and also given what you quite rightly said, not everybody has the equal access to the means of production or financing. It's absolutely gobsmacking that there are so many great lesbian filmmakers and trans films out there that to choose from. So there's not a sense that, you know, I wish there was, yeah, Desert Hearts. I remember watching Desert Hearts back in the 90s and what a wonderful film that was. And Watermelon Woman, which I only watched quite recently, and again has that push against that idea of trauma, even as it's looking at trauma. You know, it's totally aware of history, but as you say, in a very playful way.
It has fun. Like, I mentioned that there's this misconception that a lot of queer films are like really depressing and only about death and whatnot. But The Watermelon Woman is fundamentally about the absence of Black bodies, especially in queer movies, not just in Hollywood history in general, but like there is a problem with a lack of representation of people of color within American queer cinema, particularly. And Cheryl Dunier is able to interrogate those ideas with such levity and such a sense of humor without having to sacrifice her own feelings of ambivalence about having to create fiction in place of, you know, quote unquote, real history.
Absolutely. And I mean, one thing I'd also want to make sure that we don't forget, I'd like to get your comments on this as well, is the book is beautifully illustrated by Andy Warren. And it's a real bonus to the book that you get these illustrations. As I say, it's a real bonus. Did you, were you sort of talking with your illustrator as part of that, or was he delivering those and you seeing them for the first time?
He was delivering those and I was seeing them for the first time as the book was wrapping up. And I just feel like it's incredibly thankful and grateful that Andy Warren is so talented, like a really, really terrific designer and illustrator. And I feel that this is like a really terrific marriage of his illustrations and designs and my words. And it really makes the book. It's gorgeous to look at. Like, if this is going to be like something that we're encouraging people to like have in their home and have as like an object, I think it's so exciting. And I feel incredible gratitude that he's able to make something so gorgeous with Smith Street Books. And I feel very thankful to be a part of that. And it's really astonishing that he's able to sort of take these movies and distill them into like its purest essence in a single image. And I think it is to me, not to bash anyone else's book or anything, but like it's fun to see like what an illustrator is going to do with a film, as opposed to just having a screenshot of the film in the book. Like, this is his point of view about the film next to my point of view about a film, and they sort of come together to create this harmony, I guess.
It's a real conversation. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, the other thing, again, you know, but I understand the ins and outs of making a book can be quite difficult, but it's always the same three shots you get for every film. You know, it's not like there's a huge amount of, you know, film stills that you can use for it.
Press,
you know,
stills and stuff.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's refreshing from that point of view as well. So at the end of each of your sections, you recommend other films. So you do sort of manage in that way to sort of sneak out of just having the budget. So if you were allowed like 101 films, which would be the one that you would have sort of
the. So you are correct in that technically there are 200 movies in the book. I did sort of cheat and have each entry have like a wine pairing, if you will. If you like this movie, you might like this movie.
Goes well with Gorgonzola.
Exactly. Or fava beans and a nice Chianti. If I were to pick another movie that would be like 101, it would be a toss up between, I know that like he is overrepresented in the book, but I can't help that he is one of my favorite filmmakers of all time, and I think his work is quite valuable. It would be Todd Haynes' Safe from 1995 with Julianne Moore. And she plays a housewife who becomes allergic to her environment and starts like having nosebleeds and whatnot. I love that movie so much. And that's included as a sidebar recommendation, but it was something that I did kind of want to write about more at length. But you know, space and list constraints and whatnot. So it'd be either that one, or I saw it after I filed the manuscript, but there's a film called Please Baby Please with Andrea Riseborough and Henry Melig, who of Harry Potter fame, he was Dudley, I believe, and Cole Escola, the really wonderful comedian and actor. And it is like West Side Story meets Rebel Without a Cause meets Rainer Werner Fassbinder meets John Waters meets Judith Butler.
Where are they meeting? on the set of Querelle.
Yes, exactly. It is very much that kind of like lurid color, very stripped down aesthetics. They're talking so explicitly about the nature of desire and gender. And Andrea Riseborough like goes to the walls. It's a really, really an incredible performance. But that one's a lot of fun. And that would also be like a fun pick for number 101.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's also something that's great in the book is as you go through it, as you get towards the end, there is a real sense that, wow, we're really opening up possibilities here. There's so much more we can talk about. And we can kind of sort of, you know, there's a lot more room for, although I hesitate to say this after we've talked about Funeral Parade of Roses, but, you know, there is more fun. There is an element that we can get on.
Absolutely.
Right. Last question then, Kyle. Could you recommend another film book for our listeners?
Yeah. One of my favorite books is called This Young Monster by Charlie Fox, which is a collection of essays. He's, I think, London-based or UK-based writer. He's written for the New York Times, Dazed, Paper Magazine. He has a really, really beautiful point of view about the monstrous. And so this is a collection of essays about monstrosity and outsider identity. And he has this like very long essay about Rainer Werner Fassbinder, which was featured in the Paris Review. He has some essays about like his experience as a disabled queer person and how that informs his critical point of view. He has this really, this is not included in the book, but a really beautiful essay that was included in the New York Times Magazine about Frankenstein as queer metaphor. And so he has such a rigorous and invigorating style and sense of language. And he's just like one of the most exciting writers I've ever read. And so This Young Monster by Charlie Fox is really, really great.
Fantastic. Brilliant. Well, listen, Kyle, thanks so much for joining me and congratulations on the book. It's a really, as you said, lovely to look at because of the illustrations as well, but it's a really great read and I recommend it to anybody interested in cinema.
Thank you so much for having me, John. This has been so much fun. I really appreciate it.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style. Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.